tossed and turned and slapped around. The sturdiest landmark he had was a ball of rust-colored kelp, and that too was swishing around in the currents. He bobbed from the water, filled his lungs with air, added a final gasp to his mouth, and went under. The burble of water, the churning of his arms and legs, bubbles trickling past his cheeks and ears. He opened his eyes. He was just a few feet below the surface, but the cloud-diffused sunlight fought to penetrate the heaving seas and screams of bubbles. He kicked deeper, casting about for any glimpse of pale skin. With his breathing exercises, he trained himself to go without breath for a couple minutes, even while fighting at full force. But that was in open air, not in a cold ocean, fighting his every movement. Too soon he had to resurface. He took three long breaths, held the fourth, and plunged back in. He swam straight down, turning in a spiral. Something brushed his leg. He shuddered and glanced up. Seaweed. He realigned himself head down, then cried out, gurgling. A pale body was suspended below him. He kicked down, snagged it by the armpit, swapped his feet for his head, and fought toward the surface. He broke through, surging up and sucking in a deep breath. He pulled the woman up, sinking down as he did so, waves smacking over his nose. She was hardly a woman. Late teens at best. And quite oddly, in defiance of all rhyme, reason, decorum, or desire to survive, she appeared to be entirely naked. And at least half dead. Blotched face, blue lips. He rolled on his back, holding her to his chest, and stroked toward shore. His teeth chattered uncontrollably, clacking like the finger drums of the Clan of Red Sky. It was going to be a fun bit of business hauling the girl all the way back to the caves before he dropped dead of hypothermia. She spasmed and choked, spewing water into the air. She heaved for breath. With that first taste of air, she grabbed at his body and climbed up him, keeping her head from the water by pushing his under it. He kicked back up. He had plenty of size and strength on her, but she was in full-blown, can't-breathe panic, and she clung to him like the buoy he wasn't. He went under again. Again he wrestled his way back to the surface. She raked his chest, clawed his shoulder, bright lines of pain scored his skin. "Knock it off!" he burbled. She screamed and pulled at him, just as he was going for breath. The first half was air, the second was water. He dropped below the waves and filled his lungs with salt and wet. He kicked wildly, but she was holding him down, using him like a human raft. His sight tightened, dimmed, grayed. Blackness. But he could see different shades of black. Vague arms of matter reaching for him, touching his nail-raked skin, merging with the blood floating from his body. A part of him wanted it, and it reacted to his want like a hungry lover. He reached for it, and it responded. Cold lips pressed against his. His chest jerked. He felt so perfectly still, as if even his heart had gone quiet. And then his body stiffened like a plank, and he coughed salt water, and he was lying on a gritty beach with a naked girl blowing air into his mouth. He gagged and jackknifed to a sitting position, drooling all over his chest, hacking and gagging. The brackish tastes would not leave his mouth. The girl whacked him on the back. In sudden fury, he cocked his fist, coiled his muscles, and stopped. She wasn't attacking him. She was saving him.
"What?"
he wheezed.
"You went under," she said. "I had help."
He stopped and coughed some more. He was shivering and chattering.
"Who are you?"
"Helen," she said, words chopped up by her chattering teeth.
"Can you stand up? We have to get warm."
He lurched to his feet. He wobbled and she grabbed his arm, exposing her small breasts. Despite his shock and pain and cold, he immediately felt supremely awkward. He averted his eyes and tottered toward the cliffs. His sodden small clothes streamed water to the sand.
Where are you going?
She called. He didn't answer, just wobbled over to where he'd shed his cloak. He desperately wanted to throw it around his own shoulders, but he wrapped it around her instead.
Here.
He snugged it tight. Let's go. His shoes were there, too, but he was too stiff to go for them. They staggered down the beach, leaning on each other. Gripping his upper arm, her fingers were as cold as stone before sunrise. He couldn't feel the sand grinding under his feet. She tripped and dropped to her knees and stayed there. Praying he wouldn't fall too, he hauled her back up. The caves were far down the beach. So far. It would be much easier to fall down and lie there. Hot defiance burned up his throat and down his spine. It wasn't time to die. They trudged on. As they neared the caves, his hands and ankles began to tingle. That was either very good or very bad. Beside the cliffs, a woman in a flapping cloak called out. She ran to them, goggling between the girl and Blaze. Shadows flocked to her hands. A trickle of warmth seeped into his skin. She helped them inside. After the buffeting waves and deafening winds, the silence of the tunnels roared in his ears. His feet slapped the floor. One light lurched in his vision. They turned this way and that. He was deposited before a snapping fire. Towels rubbed him, chafing his skin. Someone pulled off his soaked shirt, his small pants. He was too woozy to protest. Two more women arrived. One set her hands on his chest, while the other tended to the girl. His teeth stopped beating against each other. He took an endless, shuddering breath.
What happened?
A woman crouched over him, red hair cut close to the scalp except for a strip running down the center of her head. He tipped his head toward the girl, who was wrapped in three blankets, juddering like a wet dog.
I think she fell in.
I did not, the girl said. I was betweening. Something must have gone wrong. This man pulled me out.
And in your gratitude, you attempted to kill me.
Her pale face flushed from chin to scalp.
I'm sorry. I don't know what happened.
He closed his eyes. I've seen it before. When we get close to death, we don't think about anything but escaping it. Anyway, you saved me too, didn't you?
She looked down. I might have.
So we're even. We'll share some stew sometime. The door opened. Min burst inside, eyes bulging.
Are you all right? What happened?
Somebody else tell her, Blaze croaked. I can barely talk.
Helen was between, the redhead woman said. Lost in the waves. Your dog paddled out and retrieved her. Min pressed her palms together and held them tight to her mouth.
Is everyone all right?
We've warmed them. They're fine. I'll get tea. Min paced around while Blaze warmed various parts of himself in front of the fire. He toweled off on a blanket and slung it aside. Min exited. He was suddenly too tired to do more than stare at the flickering orange flames. Min came back with a spare set of clothes. He hopped into them. The redhead woman returned with tea. Blaze gargled his, rinsing out the taste of salt.
What's between?
Min turned to the woman.
Maybe you'd take Helen to get dressed.
The woman laughed.
Enjoy yourself.
She helped the girl stand, then walked her out. Min closed the paper-thin door and spoke in a low tone.
Thank you for saving her.
Wouldn't you have done the same? He said. Or would that interfere with the people's save-yourself ethos?
By the way, I'm fairly out of it, yet I've managed to notice you persist in ducking my question. What was Helen doing in the water?
What is between?
Min was quiet a moment.
Worlds.
Worlds?
Between worlds. It's a process we discovered long ago.
When we find outsiders and bring them here to become people,
They must place themselves between life and death.
Like, for fun? Blaze gargled another mouthful of tea and spat it at the fire. The salt was impossible to wash out, as if it had marinated him.
To become one of us.
You think the best way to add to your numbers is to convince recruits to kill themselves?
Betweening is voluntary.
And what happens if they don't take part?
Min took his cup and refilled it. Bitter steam wafted from the dark liquid.
They're sent home.
Throw yourself into the waves, or be exiled. He laughed harshly, then choked.
He soothed his throat with more tea.
No wonder you're all so grim.
You don't understand. We go between to make ourselves stronger. When there is nothing left but you, your heartbeat, and death, the Nether comes so close a child could touch it. There is no better way to train those who can't yet do what we do.
Blaze blinked. Well, that would explain what just happened to me. When I was drowning, I saw it melt. I could melt it again right now.
You can.
She moved close enough to feel the heat of her skin.
How?
By wanting it.
Show me.
He set his tea on the mantel and focused on the Nether in her. He saw it, touched it, wanted it. It became liquid, reaching back at him.
Min's eyebrows shot up. Welcome to summer.
Thank you,
he said. Now please explain why you throw girls into the ocean naked, but treat me like I can't be trusted with anything sharper than a spoon.
She folded her arms.
You weren't vetted.
Do you think I'm no good? Too weak? That I can ever be one of you?
It doesn't matter what I think. And if I cared what they think, I wouldn't have put my Lee on the line to take you in.
Lee? Blaze sighed. Do you expect me to know what that is?
It's... She rolled her hand through the air. My reputation, my standing, my place as a part of Pocket Cove. They didn't want you here. I did.
Why?
I already told you, because we all deserve to be free.
No more bullshit.
He picked up his mug and slugged it down.
It tasted like spirits without the burn, like food for the soul. Take off the kid gloves. Tell me what to do and I'll do it.
She stared him down.
You have no standing to make demands of me. I'm the only reason you're allowed to stay.
I think I can do more. That I can complete the same trials the rest of you endure. Do you think I'm wrong?
I can't know that until we try.
She held her ground, but her gaze softened.
I'll discuss it with Ro.
Wonderful.
He pushed his palms into the small of his back, stretching his spine until he thought the bits might pop.
Now why don't you tell me what Helen's training to do?
To move Earth.
I know that, which is why you think it's safe to tell me that.
So why don't you tell me the rest? How do you go unseen?
Min laughed and shook her head.
Just because I'm embarrassed and humbled doesn't mean you can bully me into blabbing.
How about I ask you nicely, as someone who just risked his life to save one of your people? People who look at me like I'm a farm dog of questionable house training.
Shadow Walk.
He threw off his blanket.
Is that their name for me?
That's what we do. We shadow walk. Move through the places others can't see.
What does that involve? Besides words that sound like a foreign language.
Exactly what it sounds like.
Her eyes ticked between his.
We walk through the shadows. We move like the Nether, invisible, silent. And you'll never know we're there.
Okay, he said. I'm gonna need you to teach me that right now.
Min shook her head.
Summer first, dog. You've seen, reached, melted. Now you learn to move it. In summer, people want to slow down, to rest. It's too hot. But the rest of nature wants to grow, to move upward. The nether does, too. Can you make the darkness grow?
You know, my friend didn't have to move through a mystical gauntlet. All he had to do was read an old book.
The cycle? That's the one. Blaze bit his lip.
How'd you know that?
I thought you guys isolated yourself from earthly affairs.
We haven't always been so isolated.
She shifted her weight, then moved to a pile of pillows in the corner and sat down.
The cycle is a tool for people who don't require this depth of training. Exposure to it is enough.
Whereas for people like me, it requires suicide attempts.
And you may never be all that good,
Min smiled. But you're more dedicated than most. Whatever your limitations, that helps.
So, how do I bring summer to fruition?
Give it 3 days.
He laughed.
That's it. I mean, I'm commanding you to take 3 days off. Lyle's balls, an hour ago you nearly drowned. Now you want to skip right through the last season.
Well, all right. But in return I demand more tea.
He thought she was babying him, but whatever the red-headed woman had done to push death from his shoulders, it wasn't complete. He was soon tired, and after that he was so weak he could do no more than wander back through the halls, with Min's guidance, to his bed. He slept until he felt good. That took 2 days. Once he'd relieved his bladder, the tunnels had water closets with holes in the ground, cunningly wrought to drain moisture from the plateau down through them and wash it out to sea. They even had valves to rinse yourself with. He ate what must have been an entire flounder.
Finished? Min said, once he'd flopped into a heap of his blankets. Then let's go see Ro.
Clutching his bloated stomach, he righted himself and followed her down the tunnels. Ro's room was thick with the smell of singed wintrel leaves. The woman combed her fingers through her gray-streaked hair and shifted on her cushion of blankets.
What are you doing here?
Blaze covered his mouth to suppress a belch.
My master is taking me for a walk.
Arf! She narrowed one eye in distaste.
Why did you come to Pocket Cove?
I'm guessing Min's already told you. That hasn't changed. I came to learn to disappear, to walk outside without fear of being seen.
Do you consider yourself a part of this place?
Despite all your efforts to keep me separate from it.
The woman chuckled. Thank you for saving Helen from the waves.
You're grateful. I figured a drowning here and there must serve to strengthen the herd.
We keep ourselves strong, so we're able to keep ourselves safe.
There was an edge of warning in her voice.
We don't need to kill our own to do that, so if you will accept it, thank you.
You're welcome, he demurred.
Is that the reason you summoned me here?
Min has permission to train you however she sees fit.
Ro smiled at Min.
And if he drowns, remember to bury the corpse 6 feet deep. The sand does an awful job concealing the smell.
Min didn't seem to know if she ought to smile. She inclined her head and took Blaze outside. It was as cold as ever, but he hardly noticed.
It's summer, she said. Can't you feel it?
It would feel more like it with a cold drink.
Time to feel the nether grow. And when it's ready, to take it.
How would one of your perfect recruits be instructed to grow and to take it?
She ambled toward the tideline. By swimming naked in the worst of winter, or running through fire, or being sent to the plateau shoeless and unarmed.
He scratched his neck. His beard was getting thick.
This truly helps them progress into things other than a worm's breakfast. When you're between, your only weapons are your wits, your hands, and the nether.
What could be more motivating?
Sex, booze, a roasted pheasant smothered in gravied mushrooms. No? Then I'll take the cliffs.
She nodded once and headed toward the staircase.
You'll spend 3 days in the Fingers. You can come down any time, but if you return early, you'll be sent home.
What if I don't know where home is?
Then you carry your home in your pockets, don't you? Free to make it wherever you wish.
He unbuckled his sword.
Keep it safe for me.
She wagged her finger.
Knife, too.
He glanced at his ankle in mock surprise.
Oh, this isn't one of those killing knives. This one's purely sentimental.
Oh, what cherished memories does it carry?
Killing things.
He handed it over. She pocketed it. You can keep your shoes if you like. We don't normally send people up to the Fingers this late in the year.
If it costs me a toe, that's why the gods gave us 10 of them.
But if you come down early, I'll have to send you out.
I want to do this the way the people do. Otherwise it means nothing.
He pulled off his shoes and handed them over.
Practice too much with wooden swords, and when the real thing comes out, you're liable to get gored.
Min pointed to the overcast sky.
It's noon, or close enough to it to pretend. I'll see you in 3 days.
He grinned, and surprised himself by hugging her. Equally surprised, she patted his back. He walked to the stairwell. Without Min there, it went pitch black after the first turn. The steps were damp with ocean spray. He moved up in perfect silence, trailing his fingers over the walls. Eventually, light peeped from above. He turned a corner and was shrouded in light. It was cloud-filtered and wintry, as weak as noontime got. But after the blankness of the staircase, it was blinding. Well, that was 2 minutes down. Only 4,000-something to go. Fog slunk between the upthrust columns. Moss and vines clung to knobs of rock and wedged their roots into nooks. The ground was slippery, a mishmash of bare stone, thick mud, moss and water that couldn't decide whether it aspired to be frozen, slush, or fluid. A peaty, half-rotten odor lingered among the smells of fresh and salt water. Water was going to be a problem. Finding stuff that wouldn't turn him into a two-ended fountain, anyway. But he might be able to find some clean pools condensed on the fingers of rock. Or lick it from the moss or something. At least he wouldn't be doing any sweating. Maybe water wouldn't be so much of a problem after all. It was just 3 days. The cold, on the other hand, that was liable to kill him. And if he didn't find some way to insulate his feet, or at least keep them off the ground, his dancing days were over. There was the matter of the giant centipedes, too. As he had that thought, an ant the size of his thumb wandered over a clump of moss and stopped to wave its antennae at him. Blaze frowned. Forget food, water, shoes, or shelter. The first thing he needed was a basher. A fist-sized rock at the base of a column would do for now, but he really needed a stick, something that would keep his precious hands at a safe remove from all stingers, mandibles, and smelly ichors. He wiped the rock's muddy bottom off on a patch of fuzzy lichen and stepped forward, keeping one eye on his feet. A single cut could be the end of him. It quickly became apparent that there weren't a lot of trees up here. Nor anything, really, besides fog, the slimier sort of plants, and bugs so big it made you want to sit down and cry. After just a few minutes, he had to sit on a rock and tuck his feet into his lap and rub the feeling back into them. You really shouldn't have accepted Min's offer to keep his shoes. Principles were for idiots. Once he'd warmed his feet, he moved on. Most of the rock pillars were as steep as towers, but he soon found one with a natural staircase. On a lark, maybe it was a sign. He climbed it to a small plateau. A gnarled tree grew up there, orange berries festooning its branches. With no idea whether the berries were poisonous, he let them be, but beard-like grey-green moss hung from the branches as well. He tore this off, wiped off as much moisture as he could on the thighs of his trousers, and put the moss in his pockets. He tore off a springy branch as long as his arm and as thick as his big toe. What he really needed was a proper bug-whomping log, but the stick would do for now. Careful not to slip, he got back down, rubbed his feet some more, and wandered on. And that was as exciting as it got for 3 hours. Bouts of walking regularly, interrupted by bouts of sitting and soul-rubbing. On the 8th or 9th stop, he noticed 3 toes on his left foot had gone numb. The moss in his pocket was dry, but unless he ripped up his clothes, something he was loath to do, given that he was barely warm enough as is, he had nothing to secure the moss to his feet with. He picked at bark on his stick, but it was much too thick and rough to tear into strips. Grass grew beside a pillar, but it would shred within seconds of walking. His clothes were the only way. Stomach rumbling, he found a loose string on the bottom of his cloak and began to pick at it. He unraveled 8 feet of string, booted his feet in moss, and tied it in place. Ha! His laugh died in the mist. He got up, hefting his stick, and decided to see if there was any food that wouldn't wriggle all the way down his throat. Not 10 minutes later, the string tore from his left foot, dragging moss behind him. He secured it back around his foot, but the same incident repeated twice. He sat down and pressed his palms to his forehead. He did his breathing trick to warm himself up a bit, and then, to boost his sagging morale, he climbed around on the rocks until he found a shallow, fresh-smelling pool. It tasted good, and if he caught a disease, so what? At that point, the warmth of a fever would feel good. Using the stick, he poked around in lichen and moss, exposing a handful of white grubs. They twitched disturbingly, but a quick chomp ended that. They tasted fatty, almost sweet, but it wasn't much, and only stirred his hunger. The day grew short. He picked up his pace, eyes out for shelter. Could be a natural cave around. The people of the pocket might even have built a cabin or something to house those anyone on sentry duty in the fingers. Twilight came, then a descending gloom. With the stars and moon blocked by fog, he curled up beside the eastern exposure of a pillar, shielded from the worst of the mist and steady wind, and proceeded to pass what might have been the most miserable night of his life. On the second day, he decided all this running around was foolish. It wasn't as if he had to find the necessities of life. He didn't have enough to work with here. If he'd mysteriously woken up in the fingers, he wouldn't try to live here. He'd walk out of it as fast as possible. Find somewhere with trees whose branches you could use to bash mammals whose skin you could wear to avoid dying. All he had to do was get through another 48 hours. Then it was back to the caves. No point breaking his back with the end so close. Anyway, he was supposed to be up here to get closer to the nether. He sat with the bottom of his cloak swaddled around his feet and practiced his seasons. And there it was, all right. Shadows everywhere. Fall no longer took him any thought. Winter was as easy as a snap of his fingers. Spring still required conscious focus, but now that he knew the mood necessary to make the nether pliable, he could do so
with few failures. To shore up his ability, he spent the rest of the day getting the nether to melt. Now and then he got up to stir his blood. On one such meander he found a rock structure so massive a rivulet of water trickled down its side. He let it pool in his palm to make sure it wasn't clouded with bad humours, then drank until his thirst went away. His stomach sucked against his backbone, but there wasn't much he could do about that. To help ignore it, he cycled through his three seasons, repeating spring over and over. He got lost in the work. Instead of walking around when he got cold, he breathed in and out, tensing and relaxing, willing his temperature to rise. Night came, and all warmth went. Nether seemed to fill the void, surging everywhere. He called out to it like you'd call in the herd. It wobbled but refused to detach from the moss, like a drop of water clinging to the underside of a windowsill, defying gravity. He woke. It was light again. His cloak was draped over his lower half. One of his moss-wrapped feet stuck out. He was very warm. He lay there, enjoying the sensation. Shadows roiled over him, mingling with the mist. He'd never felt closer to peace. With a completely inappropriate sense of amusement, he realized he was on the brink of death. He bolted upright, rubbing himself down from head to toe with his cloak. As soon as his fingers and toes began to tingle, he jogged slowly between the rocks, kicking his knees high, shaking his hands. He began to shiver uncontrollably, but he thought that might be good. As his wits returned, he felt sick, starved, weak and clumsy and exhausted. He knew if he lay down again or let himself sit for longer than a few moments, he'd drift off, and he wouldn't return. So he walked, and when he got too tired, he leaned against a pillar until he felt well enough to go on. He'd gone some distance from the staircase, but without a clear sense of the sun's position, and with his head swimmy and confused, he wasn't positive he was heading in the right direction. His feet hurt. At some point the moss wore away. It was afternoon, probably, but that meant he had a whole day left in the fingers. He stopped with no strength or will to keep searching. A couple of tears wound down his cheeks. He tasted salt on the back of his tongue. He closed his eyes. A faraway rumble carried through the silence. In his state, he felt certain that Dante had found him and was punching a chasm in the ground that he'd tumble inside, never to be found, the same fate as Lyra. Just one more bag of nether being returned to the messy web of shadows that enwrapped the whole planet. The rumble faded. 3 seconds later it repeated. It was the surf. He blinked back his tears, feeling foolish, and headed toward the sound. The fog thinned. Below him, white-yellow sand curved to north and south. He found the staircase soon thereafter, and sat beside it to massage his feet. A deep part of him yearned to stagger down it and end this nonsensical quest. Just what was he doing here? Not just up here in the fingers, willingly shaking hands with death, but in Pocket Cove at all. But he felt his ego tear from its cocoon, grab him by the collar and scream into his ear. He wasn't going to give in. He wasn't going to die. He was going to find greatness. That night, the nether flitted around him like black shooting stars. He tried to summon the shadows to his hands, but it remained as aloof as the heavens beyond the clouds. He persisted. Morning came. He stood beside the stairs until the sun's blocked glow stood overhead. One step at a time, he descended, standing on the sand. Min's face was white with worry. He collapsed.
It took a few days of sleeping to prove he was fine. He wasn't certain what he'd learned betweening in the fingers, except that he never wanted to do that again. But he did feel closer to the Nether. He spent days at the tide pools, urging it to separate from its hosts and come to him. When that stalled, he stripped nude and dived into the waves, meaning to literally shock himself out of his rut. It felt incredible, doubly so once he got out and ran to the caves to shudder in front of a fire. But the wisdom of summer remained elusive. The actual year ended. He stood on the beach to see the first dawn. Min joined him. "Where is summer?" Blaze laughed.
"In hibernation."
"How are you trying to move the Nether?"
"By calling to it, summoning it. That's what you're supposed to do, right?"
"Why should it listen?"
"Because I say so."
A wave retreated, and he watched pea-sized crabs scurry to bury themselves in the wet sand.
"Seriously, because I want it to. Is that wrong?"
She folded her arms. "Hell if I know."
"Oh.
That's one of those questions where the answer is whatever I find in myself. Hate those ones."
"Then answer it quickly and get it over with."
"Because it wants death and knows that I will die," he blurted.
"Are you afraid of that?"
"That's why they call it death, isn't it?"
"They do," she conceded. "But I didn't ask about them. If I told you that you'd die tomorrow, what would you do?"
"Check your sleeves for poison," he laughed.
"I do nothing. Climb up to the fingers and watch the surf."
"That's it. I've had fun. I came here to be reborn. If, instead, my life were to end, maybe that's the same thing."
"Are you serious?" she said. "Or is that typical soldier bravado?"
He shook his head.
"Who can tell until it happens?"
She nodded toward his waist. He glanced down. A fly had landed on his fingers. He jerked his hand to dislodge it, but it held fast. He looked up and gaped. Min grinned. The shadows swirled around his finger, cold in the way that it felt when he held his hand above a sheet of ice. He'd done it. His year was over.
Chapter 15.
"A white sword," Ast said. "Well, we'll never hear from the monsters again."
Dante lifted its tip. "This sword is taken from Barden."
Ast laughed. "The white tree doesn't shed leaves or branches. Since the day it sprouted, it hasn't been broken."
Dante nodded, mildly impressed by Ast's knowledge.
"Until I got there."
He wheeled the sword over his head and slammed it into a table. The blade hit the wood with a jolt to the wrist. Instead of the ring of steel, the impact made a flat crack. The sword passed through and bit into the ground. The table teetered, then fell in half, parted down the middle. Onlookers gazed at the weapon. After a pause, Vincent knelt by the table and rubbed the cleaved edges.
"Waste of a good table."
"Cappers may be toughened against Nether." Dante wiped dirt from the sword's tip. "But this could cut the clouds from the sky."
Ast rubbed his hand down his mouth.
"Are you provisioned?"
"For a month or more."
"Then we move now. If the blizzards beat us to the divide, no amount of want will get us through."
C tipped back her head to the clear blue skies.
"Do you know something we don't, pal?"
"Yes."
Ast patted his pockets, reminding himself of what was on his person. "The names of 3 dozen men who've died on those peaks."
"Oh."
Don't you want to discuss your payment? Dante said.
A man of your stature has the means to make it worth my while, and I'm sure a man of your honor will see that it is fair.
He excused himself and jogged toward the cliffside homes.
Somber moved beside Dante.
You know this man?
Dante nodded.
Like I said, he's the one who led us to the lights.
I don't trust him.
You don't trust anyone.
People have odors,
Somber said unhappily.
He reeks of betrayal.
Then it's good you're here to watch my back.
While he waited for Ast to return with his personal effects, Dante spoke with Vincent about compensating Sol for the table. Vincent attempted to brush it off on the grounds that whatever mission Dante was on would likely enhance the villagers' safety, but Dante sat at an intact table and penned a quick note to Ollivander to be delivered to Narashtovic by whoever was heading that way soonest. As he finished, he allowed himself a small smile. This was just the sort of responsibility Ollivander would want to see him take. Ast returned wearing a long sword with a round guard, its scabbard carved with a spiral reminiscent of a kappa's horn. Dante assigned him a pony. Ast eyed the creature, ran his fingers through its thick mane, bent to examine the tufts around its sturdy hooves. Satisfied, he swung into the saddle and moved to the point. The ponies trudged up the switchback north of town without hesitation. At the grassy meadow above, shepherds shielded their hands to watch the team strike out for the wilds. Lou raised his hand and waved. A woman waved back. The ponies had some problems with the talus fields beyond the meadow. They picked their way, step by step, planting each hoof firm before trusting it to hold. They resumed their pace at the pine forest. Dante could smell the cold in the air. Pine needles, too, but the odor had changed. It was more brittle, as if the trees had retreated into themselves in advance of the coming freeze. As the daylight grew hard and yellow, Ast spoke for the first time since departing from Sol.
Where do you intend to sleep? The ponies can't climb up to a cave.
Somber and I worked that out on the way here, Dante said. It's a bit gruesome, but less so than waking up to a herd of mauled ponies.
Ast scowled.
Anything would be.
They rode along the cliffs, edging the forest, stopping once they spotted the cave Dante had created on their first time through. It was too small for all of them to sleep in comfortably, but three could fit in without problem. And should disaster strike, in the form of malevolent beasts or indifferent storms, they could pack themselves tight until Dante was able to expand it enough to stretch their legs. They grazed the ponies on the thin, dying grass. As soon as the sun fell below a ridge, Dante heaved up a saddlebag and extracted a squirrel, two possums, three rats, two rabbits, and eight mice. All were undead. He and Somber had been collecting them since Somber devised this plan on their second night out from Narashtovic. It was straightforward enough that Dante likely could have conceived it on his own, but he appreciated, A, that Somber had shown more foresight, and B, was not squeamish about using the animals as sentries. He sent his half of the creatures scattering into the twilight to keep their eyes out for kappas and more mundane predators. There would be bears in the mountains. They might have already retired to their caves for the winter, but any wolves in the area would be growing hungrier by the day. Somber kept his half of the scouts on the fringes of camp, near enough that the rustling made Dante's heart leap every few minutes.
Where exactly in Wesley do you intend to go?
Ast asked during their dinner of completely unremarkable travel fare.
We're not yet sure, Dante said. Do you know it well enough to offer suggestions?
You're braving the wardens, on the verge of winter, and you don't know where you are going?
We're following the lights. We were told we could learn more about them in Wesley. Do you know of such a place?
asked Chewed, thinking.
No.
Then get us through the Wodans via the safest route possible. We'll take it from there. Both he and Samba could have slept the whole night. The creatures would wake them through their mental link should they encounter anything dog-sized or larger. But Dante stayed up the first few hours anyway, listening to the woods, its screeching owls and lonely coyotes. He was glad he wasn't alone. The cold of the night persisted through the morning. The others were stiff and grouchy, and so was he. "Think we can risk a fire tonight?" he said. Ast glanced across the woods. "Kappas know that campfires are attended by their favorite kind of walking meat, so it depends on how much confidence you have in your rats and your sword." Dante nodded, mildly annoyed at Ast's lack of faith. Dante may have been an outsider, but he wasn't some wealthy, sheltered nobleman hiring locals to help him hunt cougars or bears. He compressed his irritation and prepared for the day's ride. The forest quit abruptly, depositing them into an endless scree of rocks of all sizes. Ast scouted ahead for paths of solid stone that would be better suited for the ponies. Eager to prove himself, Dante joined the search. He may not know the mountains, but he could damn well tell the difference between jumbled stones and an even surface. They rode for miles, stopping whenever the ponies balked and needed to be detoured. "Did you intend us to skirt the ravine?" Ast asked as the day wore on. "Or were you thinking of bridging it?" "Bridging," Dante replied at once. "This time I don't have to worry about conserving myself to build caves each night, nor about exhausting my power to heal or do harm. In his own right, Somba's just as capable as I am." Ast didn't look entirely convinced, but he didn't object. They exited the spread of talus and stopped before the ravine. While the others took the opportunity to dismount, stretch their legs, and have a snack, Dante cut open his arm and let the blood fall to the ground. His gap was wider than anything he'd bridged, so rather than extending a path direct from one side to the other, he drew out his supports first, extending diagonal struts of rock to connect in the middle of the canyon. He fleshed these out with triangular junctions to help disperse the weight of their passage, then paved his bridge across the gap. Somber watched with naked curiosity. "I've always meant to ask, was that hard to learn?" "The work of months," Dante said, letting out a shaky breath, "and refining it's taken years. Do you think it would come in handy on your ventures?" "It occurs to me that if you were to open a hole in the floor beneath a person, an enemy king, say, you could drop him inside and reseal the hole and no one would ever know." "That's a disturbing thought." "No," Somber said. "What's disturbing is the thought of liquid stone flooding their mouth to choke off their screams." He couldn't argue with that. Dante walked across the bridge himself to test it, delving his focus into the reshaped rock. He felt no hint of weakness or strain. Though the icy stream glittered 100 feet below, the ponies were well used to clambering around on narrow paths and mountain slopes, and didn't slow down as they were led to the other side one by one. They crossed a snowfield, descended to another forest. That night, Dante spent his time on watch looking out for the ghost lights. For Selen, but saw nothing out of the ordinary on the skies or the ground. At the second ravine, where he'd slain the Kappa, he repaired his broken bridge and buttressed it with additional support. Below, white bones showed within broken black shells. They made good time before their next camp. That night, a feeling like numbed pain spiked him from sleep long before dawn. His link with one of the mice had gone dead.
"Did you lose one too?" Somba said.
Dante jumped. "Just now. When was yours?"
12 minutes ago.
"Have you been counting the seconds?" Somba nodded.
Haven't seen the attacker.
Dante hopped between the sight of each of his remaining scouts. Their night vision was better than his, but showed nothing more than trees and pale pockets of snow.
Go back to bed, Somber said. I'll sleep in the saddle.
When Dante got back up, clouds skidded across the sky, mounting on the eastern peaks. He joined the others for breakfast. We lost two scouts last night.
Lou looked up from his cornbread.
Cappers?
Owls, I expect. But keep your eyes open.
Good tip,
C said. As it turns out, eyes are especially useful when you're stumbling around the mountains.
We've got more than cappers to worry about, Ast said, ignoring her sarcasm. We'll see a storm this afternoon.
Ahead lay the boulder-strewn field where their last trip had ended. Since they were no longer hunting the lights, Ast skirted it, swinging to the north through a notch in the ridge. Snows crusted the slopes, shrubs clinging gamely to any hold they could find. The mountains were already so high, Dante thought they must be crossing the divide. But the other side opens to an up-and-down jumble of hills, screes, and cliffs, glued together by blue-white glaciers, striated by the constant winds. On the horizon, another spread of mountains soared yet higher. Dante's ears ached. Since the day before, even moderate strain had left him taxed for breath. Ast seemed little worse for wear, and Somber's expression was as elsewhere as always, but he saw the discomfort in C and Lou's faces too.
Is it much further? He said.
Ast pulled his scarf down from his mouth. Steam gushed from his nose. He pointed to the distant peaks.
That's the divide.
Oh, thank the gods, Lou said.
Dante felt relief, but not much. The glacier field looked like the work of 2 days by itself, and unless Ast knew a hidden pass through the divide, they'd have to climb another 1,000 feet or more of stark terrain before they looked on Wesley. But it was a bit late for complaints. They moved on. Dante and Somber sent their animal scouts bounding ahead to check for pathways through the ice. After a short descent, they slogged through 4 inches of powdery snow, overlaying hard-packed ice that likely never melted. The ponies crunched along. An hour into the walk across the ice, one pony stopped and danced away, holding up its left front hoof. Dots of red pattered the snow. It had sliced itself on a blade of ice. Dante instructed Lou to heal it. Lou dismounted and sent the nether to wipe away the animal's wound. The pony snorted and hopped sideways, kicking its foot about as if it itched. Abruptly, it calmed down and gazed across the snow like nothing had happened. The skies grayed. Glittering powder gusted in flurries. One of the dead rabbits stumbled on an alternate route a quarter mile to the southeast. It required navigating a tricky frozen slope, but the glacier at the bottom flowed like a solid river for at least a mile, a much cleaner path than the eskers and slants ahead of them. Ast agreed, and they angled towards the idle rabbit scout. The powder in the air thickened, accumulating in the folds of their cloaks. It wasn't just the wind. It was snowing. By the time they got to the slope, the skies were charcoal. Incoming snow whirled around them, dropping visibility to a couple hundred yards. Ast paused before the descent. A long ramp of ice fed down to the glacier hundreds of feet below. The ice was solid and broad, but ahead and to the left, the edge plunged sharply, riddled with deep blue folds.
We'll lead the ponies.
Ast dropped from the saddle.
Slow and steady. If you hear a crack or a pop, abandon the beasts as fast as you can.
The lower half of Lou's face was muffled, but concern shined in his eyes.
and yet the angle looked worse than it was.
Ast led, swiveling his head to gauge the ground. There was little powder on the slope, and the ice beneath Dante's feet was gritty and irregular, making for relatively solid footing. They proceeded in a loose line, careful not to follow directly behind one another in case of a mishap. Halfway down the decline, with another tenth of a mile to go, Ast's pony yanked its head, tearing the reins from his gloved hands. He cursed and stomped after it. The ice to Dante's right crackled. The hair stood up on the back of his neck. He dropped the reins and tensed his legs. But it wasn't a collapse or an avalanche. 50 feet away, from behind a low mound of snow, a kappa stalked onto the ice. Dante's pony shrieked. Perhaps he did as well. Somber rushed forward, knives appearing in his hands. Dante drew his sword. Originally, the raw rib had been heavy and unwieldy, but using a combination of nether and steel chisels, which had gone blunt after 2 good whacks, he'd shaved and shaped the bone to the desired shape. By the time he'd finished work in Samaran's basement, the sword was 3.5 feet long from point to pommel, gently curved. It was thicker than most steel blades of the same shape, but hardly any weightier, and unimaginably stronger. He held it from his side and faced down the kappa. The beast dipped its head, swaying its horns back and forth. Ast's pony took a faltering step to the left. The kappa padded forward. A bow twanged behind Dante. With a hard whack, the arrow struck the kappa in the middle of its plated skull and deflected away. The kappa accelerated into a lope. Heart hammering, Dante stepped forward and raised his sword to a guard. Another pony screamed, an unnatural, whinnying cry. Lou shouted. Dante glanced back. 2 more kappas stalked down the slope behind them. "Deal with that one," Somber said, pointing to the first. "We need to clear room to run." Dante nodded and gripped the sword with both hands. Animals skittered on ice behind him. Ponies brayed, hoofs scraping. One bolted to the left, slipping on the ice. The first kappa dropped its head and rushed Dante. He could try to knock a hole in the ice, send this one plunging to its death, and race to face the other two. But he had no practice manipulating ice, and even if it operated along the same principles as Earth, and he suspected it would, he didn't know how the rest of the sheet would react if it were suddenly sheared open. He might slip and join the kappa, and any fall sufficient to kill it would surely claim him as well. So he leveled his sword and trotted forward. The kappa closed on him, snow twirling past its twin horns. He stopped and planted his feet. Moments before it impaled him, he leapt to the left, slashing at its head with his sword. The bone connected with the kappa's horn. A 2-foot spiraled point spun into the ice and stuck there. The monster thundered past him and smacked straight into a pony's flank. The animal shrieked. The kappa drove it into the ground, then backed off. Blood spurted from the pony's ribs, dripping from the kappa's intact horn. Upslope, the other 2 monsters charged through a loose knot of people and ponies. C's bow thrummed. Ponies galloped toward the left edge of the sheet, sliding as the grade fell away. Shadows lanced through the air and burst harmlessly against a kappa's armored hull. The first beast, now down half a horn, twirled away from the downed pony and romped toward Dante. He timed his second effort better, diving away at the last instant, raking his blade down its side. It bellowed. Dark blood stained the snow. Dante landed on his hip and rolled. The kappa stumbled, snow spraying from the impact of its body. Dante popped to his feet and sprinted toward it. As it found its footing, he whipped the sword into its neck. The blade ripped through the plated armor, passed through the flesh like it was no more substantial than the powder beneath their feet, and jarred to a stop against the kappa's spine. Drunkenly, the Kappa swung its head around, attempting to face him. Its legs gave out, and it collapsed on its face,